Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
Welcome to part two of a discussion with Susan Dray. And it's a really special discussion. She continues to reflect on a lot of her professional and personal experiences, but it gets much more personal and real. And she talks about things around value of empathy in listening and listening with heart. And she talks a lot about mentoring and her approaches to that, and also talks a lot about service and community. But just mentioning those labels doesn't do justice to the ways in which Susan talked about it. And I also include some of our unofficial discussion at the end, which I share with her permission, because she continues to talk about some of the losses that she's experienced and some of the health challenges and life challenges that she's had to navigate. And again, just the quality of the person comes through. And as Susan says,
I think everybody needs support, quite frankly. Yes. I think very, very few people understand and realize how special they are, you know? And what matters is who you are, because who you are is going to mean that what you do is important and makes a difference and has an impact.
And Susan has definitely had an impact. So we'll start here a little bit back from where we left off in part one. And I really hope you enjoy this very special part two with Susan Dray.
You're very self-reflective in the whole practice, in the way you've talked about being aware of the potential blinders. And also, again, that curiosity that enables you to be surprised.
Yeah.
Because what you said, you don't know you've got the blinders.
And then you hit them. And when you hit them, it can feel like you're a failure in that moment. And if you let that take over your mindset at that point, then you miss the surprises. And I've now learned that every time I do a study, regardless of where, the first couple of people, I'm going to feel really stupid. Because
and that's okay.
And that's okay. You know, learning to sit with discomfort, I think, is a really big deal. And then when you're uncomfortable, listening deeply with your heart, you know, really, really focusing on understanding as much as you can, which is, they compete with each other. You know, that's a struggle. That's always a struggle.
Can say more about that.
Well, so in the beginning of the township study, for instance, we were trying to understand what they did with money in general. And, you know, I have a client with me. I'm trying to create an experience that's a good experience for her. We are also working with a local vendor, of course. We never, ever would do that on our own. We worked with the local vendor. They consulted on the screener and they did the recruitment. And then they went with us and had a facilitator and two translators so that they could switch off, because we tried to, as much as possible, use local language. Not always possible, but as much as possible. And it was so hard in the beginning to just relax enough and allow myself to feel the discomfort and not just react by going, you know, just use it as information. Oh, this is important information here. You're learning stuff that you wouldn't be learning otherwise.
Yeah.
And that's why you're uncomfortable.
You know?
It's that discrepancy.
How would you talk to someone about listening with your heart? Because that sounds so key for lots of things, not just doing field work.
I think that's kind of me. You know, that's kind of who I am. So listening with the heart means to me being empathetic, but also, how to say it? I guess it's kind of listening with love, a kind of honoring what the person is saying and what they're showing you in their behavior, even when they don't match, but seeing that as valuable and then reinforcing that value. And certainly when I mentor folks, a lot of what I do is it's really simple because I think most people have, they know what the solution is, they just can't unpack it. So it's just sitting and saying, huh, that's an interesting question. And then ask a follow-up that then they go into and then go, really interesting. Just kind of reinforcing that the person is valuable, that you honor them, that you respect them, that you care for them.
And that's such a valuable gift that you give to all of us who've
Well,
had the honor of interacting with you over the years. Because I was actually going
no.
to go to the mentoring because I think that when you talked about listening with your heart, I was thinking about that's what I see you doing all the time in any of your
Yeah.
interactions. And I'm actually just
You've got your
I'm
hearts.
holding up here an orange and a purple heart stone that I was gifted by Susan the last time I saw her a few months ago. And just the generosity of these little gestures that you have as well that are ways of connecting with people. And you can't put a value on that presence in a peer community, in a professional community, and
Yeah.
what that gives to people.
Well, and there certainly are people who dismiss it and say, you don't have anything technical to offer, for instance. And it's been a long time since I've been in the field. I don't have technical insights, but I know how to provide support, you know, this undergirding. And also, I'm a cockeyed optimist. I get this from my father. And so I tend to see positive, you know, positives for people. And sometimes that's the most important thing is it's going to be okay. It is going to be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not done yet. You know, and yeah, that's simplistic. And, but sometimes, you know, if somebody's deeply negative about something, hearing a positive can be for them uncomfortable and can lead them to question their cynicism, say, or whatever it is. Doesn't always work, but sometimes it does.
And so that presence and listening with your heart is also in a way holding up a mirror for people, which can be to reflect
Exactly.
on where they're
Exactly.
coming from, as well as reflecting on the fact that they do have the answers.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's like peeling the onion. So sometimes what people need is that kind of listening, deep listening. But other times they need an opportunity. So, for instance, Gary Marsden and I were very dear friends. Gary was a professor at the University of Cape Town, and he was one of the key people in the early days of HCI in Africa, South Africa, but yes, Africa. I don't believe there were HCI communities anyplace else in those days. And in 2001, they had a conference, happened to be my keynote was on 9/11, the original 9/11, which was an interesting situation to be in. But luckily, I'd already given my keynote when all that went down. But it was important to listen to what they needed. And what they needed, first of all, there was a deep sense of inferiority, you know. Africa's inferior. Well, that's a pretty shitty thing that colonialism has done. Let's get rid of
Definitely.
that. So there was partly, there was, no, this is really interesting. You know, and people that most people have never heard of, like Edwin Blake, who did this amazing work providing game trackers, sand bushman trackers in national parks, but they can read a leaf that's been stepped on by an elephant half an hour ago. And they didn't have the language to express this, but he developed this tracker that they could then keep track of what their observations were, and it raised their standing. But also, he found that they were going to do it the old Western hierarchical way, right? Does not work, or didn't at that time work at all. I mean, even if you ask people to show their family tree, they would, instead of like grandparents, parents, children, they would do parents, aunt, child, uncle, grandfather, father. You know, they did not have the concept of a hierarchy. So hierarchical wasn't going to work for them. And they didn't have language, a written language at that time. I don't know if they do now. So it was all done iconographically with pictures of the different animals that had to be accurate enough that they could distinguish between a springbok and a whatever else bok it might be. Well, who knows about that work in this in the global north? Not very many people. So what they needed was, first of all, to be reinforced that they were doing important things, and they needed a voice to the global north. They needed somebody to be saying, this work is important. This work matters. This is excellent work. And that was me. So I became the voice for Africa. And Gary used to say that HCI in Africa, they never would have been able to get the kind of recognition that they have since, still not enough, but they are starting to get without having that kind of conduit. And that was me.
I mean, and that's the interstices again, isn't it?
Exactly.
In a different
Yeah.
way.
It's, yeah. And so sometimes what people need is exposure, or, you know. So another one of my mentees who was doing a PhD, Anna Fulbright, coming from Africa, and she was doing a PhD at Iowa State, and she needed a postdoc. And so we were talking. I was actually down in Panama on a Fulbright at that time. So we were talking, and it became clear that she was interested in gender studies. And I said, you should talk to Margaret Burnett. And so I hooked him up. Well, she ended up doing a postdoc with Margaret.
Oh,
And
lovely.
yeah, so it's like sometimes it's just that little,
Yeah.
you should talk to this, you should talk to this person,
Yeah.
you know, that kind of thing. And
That's
I think
a
we need.
lovely extension of your rich people skill set, that networking and connecting,
Well, I
as
think of
well as
us,
advocating, as you
absolutely.
said.
We need more of that, especially nowadays. Early career scientists and people in business as well are getting totally slammed, and we need to find ways to support them. And that's going to require the old proverbial village, right? It takes a village to raise an early career researcher, so to speak.
Yeah. Any particular ideas for what we can do right now around those challenges?
Well, one thing we can do is listen to their situation and make connections. And I was so excited at CHI because I saw that
This was
CHI
our
conference,
conference.
our recent, yeah, CHI conference in
Yeah.
Japan. And what I saw there was this sense that, A, we have to pull together to support early career people, and a real recognition of that. And we're not going to let it happen that this field gets blown apart by this. And so that may mean that it migrates to other parts of the world. It may mean, and this could be a perfect opportunity for us to raise awareness of Africa, because they're doing artificial intelligence really differently there. And, you know, the idea that AI now is training on a Western internet and
Yes.
has Western culture built into it, and that doesn't work in Egypt or Kenya or Nigeria or South Africa. I mean, it doesn't work. So their whole human-centered AI approaches are, I think they're radical. They're spreading, but I think that's a very consistent. I've been hearing that from my African colleagues for a good 5 years, more than 5 years. So I think, they're really pioneers in that. And we keep reinventing the wheel and think we invented it, right? Nope.
So
A
are
lot
you
can get.
talking particularly there about early career researchers within the American context or more generally?
I think the American context is particularly dire given the political situation in the US right now. But it has a ripple effect outside the US, obviously. And I think everybody needs support, quite frankly. I think very, very few people understand and realize how special they are. And so if you can just be that mirror to reflect that back to them, sometimes that's enough to help them have the courage to do what they have to do, whatever that might be. And
That's beautiful, Susan. And there's so much about our sector that is continually trying to reinforce messages of not being good enough, of being rejected, of,
exactly,
that the
exactly.
hyper competition that,
Absolutely. Oh, I got a Chi paper. That means I'm part of the 10% or whatever. It's like, I've never had a Chi paper.
Is that right?
I've never submitted a Chi paper. I've had case studies, I've had SIGs, I've had panels, I've done other stuff, but I've never had a paper.
Oh, that's wonderful. So there are ways of choosing your way of being in peer communities, isn't there?
Absolutely. And I wouldn't get anywhere if I tried to submit a Chi paper because the stuff I write about would be dismissed as, meh, that's not important.
Sounds
So,
like choosing what difference you want to make. And so,
I think it's Jane Goodall, I think, who says something like, whatever you do makes a difference. You just have to decide what kind of difference you want to make.
and standing confidently in that.
As confidently as you can with some support, a lot of help from your friends sometimes.
And recognizing, as you said, about standing in the discomfort of that as well sometimes and not being
Exactly.
sure and
Yeah. And I think my impression of academia, I've only been an academic for, a true academic for 4 months when I was down in Panama teaching and helping them develop curricula around HCI. In systems engineering, that was really interesting. So I can't speak to being an academic. I can be like an academic, but my impression is that because of scarcity and perceived scarcity, there's huge competition, and so there's this, sort of dog eat dog kind of thing, and I see that everywhere, not just in the U.S. Particularly pronounced in the US, I think. And it's crazy. We have different skills. We're going to fit in different places. Yeah, it's sad. It's like when the pot gets smaller, the dogs fight harder. And it's not that it's total peaches and cream in industry either, of course, but.
No, challenges everywhere, and so
Absolutely.
should look at wrapping up, I guess,
Yeah, whenever.
sadly, because it's wonderful talking. What have we not talked about that we should before we wrap up?
Well, I love mentoring, but it's such an honor. And I could run down some of the people that I've had this incredibly wonderful, precious, very precious relationship with. And the whole idea of service too, where, you get so much out of it. It's hard to imagine people don't just go, yeah, because you really end up, you meet people, you have fun, you have intellectual challenge, you have to figure out logistics, all this kind of stuff. That's just so fascinating. Now, in the beginning with Chi, so the first Chi was in Boston in 83. And then the next one was in San Francisco in 85. And that's because the one in Boston was in like December or something like that. And the next one started in the April, May time. But I have pictures of it's from 85. I was super involved with 85. And we have literally a very big paper on a bulletin board and blocks, columns for the three different rooms or however many there were, and then where you put them. And then you have to kind of swap them around. Very physical. It was totally physical. Totally different problem than we have now with 5,000 people coming and all that. But the camaraderie that we developed and the bonds that we developed and the ways that we worked with each other, those are consistent. You know, I think it's a bigger job and there's more burnout now, obviously, with the bigger job. And also with the fact that I think people have a lot of trouble. Okay, this is controversial. Personally, I think you can get an awful lot done if you don't care who gets the credit. But the mindset of we have to fight over the small crumbs here, which I think is at large, makes it hard to do that. It makes it hard to collaborate because you want people to know that this was your idea, you know? And so for me, I give away ideas all the time, and most of them are terrible. But I used to say when I do lectures, so during this lecture, I'm going to say something that's really stupid, and it's your job to figure out what it is, which is great because it took all the pressure away, you know?
Allowing yourself to be human.
Exactly. Well, I think that's something that's really hard to do. Being vulnerable does not come naturally to people who are high achievers who have lots of degrees and lots of experience with a combative mindset, you know,
And where your
just
identity's too bound up in those external validations.
yes, and in what you do. And what matters is who you are, because who you are is going to mean that what you do is important and makes a difference and has an impact. And that's what I see in these amazing people that I've had this very precious relationship with, is that they just like, wow. And it's not because of me. It is not because of me. I'm just like a little background sort of or whatever. But they then just take off and they do these incredible things. And they're very much interdisciplinary. I have to say that I've mentored, I don't know how many people, but they're primarily women, people in the global majority is what people are using right now. And women of color in the US, people of color in the US, primarily women. It's mostly women that I work with.
People come to you and ask explicitly if you would be a mentor, and do you set it up as a formal mentoring relationship, or is
No.
it much more emergent relational?
It's more emergent durational, and you recognize it in retrospect more than prospective. And, you know, David says, well, are you really a mentor because you don't have a schedule and you're not talking? But I mean, there are a lot of people right now. There are probably four people that I talk with every week in Africa primarily. But, you know, so one of the folks I'm talked to every week on Friday morning, she just needs to have somebody listen because she gets very little validation in her university, like none. And she's been forced to change her field of study somewhat because of what the university wants her to do if she wants to keep her job. And she's very multicultural in a very monoculture place, both country and university. And she struggles with that. And she also is very involved with doing her own service. And so she has issues there with dealing with the other people who are working on the conference that she's chairing or whatever it might be. So just listening means so much because she talks it out. She answers her own questions. They always do. Sometimes it takes more than one time, but yes.
Yeah. But the gift of providing that space for someone and that listening heart.
Well, people are just amazing. And people in this field are just absolutely incredible. The intellect, the heart. And I think probably the reason that I mostly work with women is not just because I'm a woman, but because women are much more open to being authentic and to learning how to be authentic. I'm not actively modeling anything. I don't think about it. It's just who I am, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But,
yeah, I love
which is
being who you are. And
amazing.
I love that you started off talking about the 1980s and the very early days, and that it's 2025, and the ways in which your role in the work that you're doing in the industry that legitimizes your participation in the community, and then your ongoing participation that has grown out of the service and out of the relationships, and the fact that you were still at the last big conference in April, which was amazing to see you there.
It was interesting because I sat back at that conference and I looked at breaks, and the Sitkai lounge was at the back of the large hall where all the food was served and the posters and all that kind of stuff. And I looked at it and I said, I recognized, maybe for the first time, that it wasn't the first time I recognized that I didn't know everybody. There was a time when I knew everybody in this field. No more. I mean, it hasn't been there for a long time. But I looked at the people and realized that my role has to be fundamentally different now. You know, I'm in the crone phase, I guess. My role must be one of simply being a support, because I'm not going to be able to contribute to the intellectual conversations that people are having. That's not what I do anymore, you know. I'm sure you're familiar with the tale of Indra's net. I believe it's a Hindu. I'm not sure where exactly it comes from. But Indra throws a net across the world. And at every place where it crosses, every intersection, there's a bell. And so whenever one person moves, the whole network moves, the whole network rings. And I think that's really true, in a sense, that we all have an influence on other people.
Yeah.
And so I love that metaphor because I think it really gets at the whole way that I see the world. It's interesting. Another thing, I think you have to be willing to be a beginner sometimes, you know, and that's awkward. I'm doing watercolor right now. I'm starting to learn about watercolor, and it's like, oh man, is that hard? And so the beginner mind is also important.
Well, Susan, you said before it matters who you are, and we're really grateful for who you are and the way that it has mattered to this community in so many different ways over the years. And
well,
for
thank
all
you
your
so much. That means so much coming from you, because you are just one of the bright lights, and you are a person who gives so much to the community and so many people. When you mention Geraldine Fitzpatrick, they say, do you know her? Isn't she amazing? So, you know, it's important. It means a lot coming from you, because
thank
I really
you,
honor and respect you. I think you're amazing.
Thank you. So, all the very best, and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you.
Now, that may sound like the end, but it's not. After we got to this point, Susan and I continued chatting informally, and this is when she started sharing about some very personal experiences often very painful experiences or dealing with a lot of different adversities. And their reflections to do with loss and getting older, and also various loss and adversity experiences across the lifespan that she's dealt with. And again, you just hear this amazing person of Susan coming through with her ability to reflect and find the positive in things and find a way through, and always with an orientation to others. So I asked Susan if I could also share some of this discussion, and she kindly agreed. So we start off here where she's talking about sailing, which is something that her and David, her husband, really love to do, and some of her particular health challenges at the moment around that. And we go on from there.
I have a couple of sailing shots, which I really like.
Yeah.
you can learn a lot from sailing.
Oh, that would be a big thing about trust as well and relationships, because you'd have to trust. I mean, you're just going with the flow, with the weather, what you control and can't control.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes you just can't get where you want to go. You can't. The wind is blowing the wrong direction, and it's going to be like gale force for the next month. And so you have to go someplace else, you know.
And do you go off sailing for months at a time?
Yes, we used to before I dislocated my hip.
Yeah.
The longest I've been living aboard was 4 months. And that was primarily intercoastal waterway. So it was protected sailing. But nowadays, it's like too dangerous for me to be on board.
I know you can't risk falling again.
But, you know, if I'm not going to be able to sail, then there are other things that I can do.
Is this the water painting part of that?
Watercolor is part of it. And I discovered early on, well, in 1987, our first daughter was 4 and a half, and our second daughter was diagnosed at 28 weeks with autosomal recessive polycystic kidney disease, which is not common. And had never been diagnosed prenatally before. So they didn't have any way of telling us what they thought the outcome would be, because it didn't usually happen. They didn't usually find it till kids were like 4 and a half, 5. That was scary. But, you know, it turned out that she died.
Oh,
and
I'm so sorry.
Well, and it's, you know, that is just such a, it is tragic. And it's not that uncommon. And we all have things like that in our lives, whether it's a child or a parent or a friend, or for some people, it's stubbing their toe, you know? And what I learned was that, well, the image I had was that we'd taken Sarah Beth's life and we put it on the countertop at Tiffany's, high-end, super expensive store, stuff I'm never going to be able to afford, even if I wanted it. And we took it, and they took away her life. It was gone. And I had two options at that point. I could walk away being angry and bitter my whole life, or I could say, well, I can't have what I really want, but I can have something else that's wonderful instead. And so that actually was the point where I cracked open. That's the point where I simply couldn't be inauthentic anymore. I had to just be who I was. And the rest is history, as they say. You know, it was, and so, I mean, I think there are some people who aren't 2x4 to the head learners like me, but if it's going to happen, you might as well learn something from it, right?
We're all different. We're all so different.
We are. And that's what makes it so wonderful.
It is. One of the courses I often teach, or workshops I run for different people, I talk about crafting your underlined, italicized, good professional life.
Yeah.
And that the main message I'm trying to get through is you can be you. And then I can give you some tools or tips and tricks about how to reflect on who's you and who you are at your best and who you want to be or whatever. But it's okay, we're all different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, my brother basically dropped dead in February. And
Oh.
so it hasn't been fun. And so I wondered, when he was dying, what did he think about his life? Did he regret anything? Did he feel? And I realized that if I were to drop dead right now, I've had an amazing life. I've had an amazing opportunity to be with and learn from so many amazing people and in so many different contexts that that richness just kind of, it's kind of seeped in. And so if I were to literally drop dead right now, it's not what I want, but
No, it's a nice point of reflection, though. Good life.
Well, I mean, I'm getting up there in age, so, and I can't keep up with the youngins anymore. So, no point in trying.
Because
But
you are
you
aware that
start,
it's sort of at the pointier end of life,
yeah, it's your legacy. It's
and
thinking
you're
about
only going
what,
to be as healthy as you are now.
yeah. Well, you can be intellectually and psychologically healthy or even healthier. Your body may not agree with you on that. My
Yes,
body
I know
doesn't
the body
agree.
definitely doesn't agree.
No, my body does not agree at all, but yeah, it's really amazing.
And that is the real end now. And Susan is really amazing. I know I have so much to reflect on after hearing the way that she's navigated the various challenges that life's thrown her way, and just coming through again and again, her deep service, her deep love of people, and her, as she says, listening with heart, and the importance of being you, being who you are, not so much what you do, but who you are. So much to reflect on. So thank you for listening, and do share this with others. I think Susan's a great role model.
You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.